Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcio Land podcast. So today, we're going to, as usual, catch up on the latest transfer rumors. De Rossi's the reports that he will play in Serie A next season. We'll get into the implications of that. We are going to talk about Juve's pursuit of De Ligt, which there was a lot of news since we had did our last episode. We have our hot transfer topics. We're going to talk a little bit about Inter, Milan, and Napoli. And we're going to have a very, very special guest, the Twitter account that has taken Calcio Twitter by storm. President Real Donald J. Agnelli is going to join us for a special interview on Juve. Then we have our Twitter questions, our patron-only Q&A. And we are going to close with our dear friend Richard Hall to talk a little bit about both Milan and Inter, the news on San Siro being potentially demolished. So we'll close on that. But before we get to this, I'm joined by our great friend, producer, co-host of the show, Alex Goldberg. His own podcast, The Byline One on Patreon, is absolutely blowing up. Check it out. So I have to tell you, Alex, yesterday afternoon, as I was thinking about today's show, I was almost certain we were going to start on De Ligt because that broke after our last episode. But I was like, geez, we've been doing a lot on Juve. It would be nice if something else breaks. And in typical Roma fashion, no dull moment with the club. There's a report from pretty much everyone in Italy, including Sky Sport and the people I work with, that De Rossi now wants to play for another Serie A team. Before, it seemed he was going to come either to MLS or go play at Boca Juniors. But now, and I suspect in large part after Totti's press conference, he's open to joining another Serie A team. So I have to ask you, Alex, looking at it from your perspective, what would intrigue you more? Which team would it intrigue you more to see him on? I mean, we have the obvious ones, Inter, Milan, Juve. I'm going to give you a couple of dark horses, Atalanta, because they're in the Champions League, Fiorentina, although today Rocco Commisso denied that, and I'm throwing in Sampdoria because his former manager, Di Francesco, is there and potentially Totti. So based on this list, which one would intrigue you the most, Alex?
Yeah, well, addressing the dark horse ones first, I think out of the dark horse ones, I would say Atalanta to do just that, to maybe help them in the Champions League. And it might not be that much on the pitch, but just to be another veteran person in that dressing room to kind of help them in their new phase, their new exciting phase. But really, David, my answer is an immediate answer, and it's Juventus. And I say Juventus because I want to see De Rossi win Serie A. I want to see him win a Scudetto. He has been at it in Serie A for a long, long time, of course, starting with Roma in 2001. And really, you can say, totally deserves a Scudetto to his name. And it's funny, I am not a big hockey fan, David. That's probably my least favorite sport out of the United States sports. But the Boston Bruins, the hockey team here in Massachusetts, used to have this player, Ray Bourque. And Ray Bourque was a very good player. But the Bruins just weren't great during his tenure in Boston, and he never got that Stanley Cup. And then eventually he moved on to the Colorado Avalanche, and he won a Stanley Cup. And I know it's not the same. The relationship between the Bruins and the Avalanche is not the same as Roma and Juventus. But just from a personal standpoint, Boston fans were so happy for Ray Bourque to win that Stanley Cup. And I really think De Rossi deserves a Scudetto to his name. I think that would be really nice. And yeah, once again, Juventus have a weakness in the midfield, like I've said a number of times on the latest podcast. It's not exactly De Rossi that they're looking for in the midfield. They're obviously looking for younger players who can do a little bit more. But Juventus is my answer. And then my second answer would be Inter, because it'd be really cool if he could help Inter end Juve's reign and win the Scudetto themselves. But my answer is completely predicated. It's completely based on who is going to give him the best chance at winning the league. And that's why I'm saying Juventus first. So, David, I want to get more perspective on it. I'm obviously in the Serie A bubble, but I'm also in a couple other bubbles. So I want to know a little further. What do you think made De Rossi change his mind? Because originally he didn't want to play for another Serie A team because of his close relationship with Roma. So what's your take on all that?
I definitely think a lot changed after Totti's press conference. And again, I don't know how much Totti did all of that independently. Was it coordinated maybe with some other people or whatnot? But that key phrase that the American owners wanted to take the Romans out of Roma, and what happened with De Rossi, I think, was the last straw for Totti when it came with the ownership. So I think it was a little bit of the dog wagging its tail. That happened. De Rossi sees that press conference. He's Totti leave the club. I think, he still knows he's a good enough player. Like, can he start 30 games a season? No, but he could easily start 20, 25 between all competitions, come off the bench, be a valuable player. So I think, once he started looking at coming MLS, which I still think it's too. I think he can do one more season in Serie A, and then he looked at potentially going to Boca Juniors in Argentina, which I think would have been a great life story. But who knows about safety, getting paid, and all those sorts of things. So I think that press conference with Totti and all really the bad will there is against the Roma ownership, he's like, screw it, I'll just play one more season. I think that in a way, De Rossi leaving was the last straw for Totti, and vice versa, Totti's press conference was the last straw for De Rossi.
Interesting. Okay, I appreciate that. Now, let's further it here. David, where do you actually see him landing?
So I liked your answer on Juve from his perspective. And I'm not going to rule them out altogether, but I think had a Buffon still been at Juve, there would have been a really, really strong chance he would go there. Buffon and De Rossi are really close. I also wonder, De Rossi knows that it's going to be a tough blow for the Roma fans to see him in another jersey in Serie A. I wonder if maybe he tries to pick his spots to maybe make it hurt a little bit less. I would say, going to Juve would be up there as the toughest. I think Inter is a really intriguing fit for him. He already played for Conte during the Euro and the 2 years that Conte was with the Italian national team. Not surprisingly, De Rossi had great things to say about Conte. You could see Conte trying to have the repeat of him signing Pirlo. Everyone thought Pirlo was done. Granted, De Rossi is a little bit older than Pirlo was. I think in a lot of ways, if De Rossi competing, being in the Champions League, trying to challenge Juve, being with Conte, competition is a big criteria for him, I think Inter makes a lot of sense. Milan too, obviously Milan's always Milan, but to me, if he's moving to a club like that, maybe Inter has an edge because of the coach and also because they are in the Champions League. Granted, De Rossi would benefit Milan a lot as a mentor. As far as the dark horses, I know Atalanta would be intriguing. They also were interested in trying to sign Buffon, although that doesn't seem that likely. They obviously would be the most intriguing, but if I had to say, other than Inter, the most likely, in my opinion, is Sampdoria. They are looking to hire Totti to be a director there. They already have Di Francesco, who was De Rossi's coach. At Roma, we know Sampdoria's president, Ferrero, is obsessed with Roma. He's from the city. He'd love to buy the club. And if you can't afford to buy the club, the second best thing would be to have Totti, De Rossi, to a lesser extent, Di Francesco there. So have it that way. So I'm going to say Inter if he really cares about competing, and Sampdoria as the backup. So, Alex, the other thing that I wanted to get to was the news on De Ligt. So I know you've been really high on him. So after we recorded on Thursday, on Friday, there was the news that Juve's back strong on De Ligt. So before we get to the negotiation and what's going on, what's your reaction to that? Like, I wanted to surprise you and ask you, what would be a more impactful addition to Juve, in your opinion, Pogba or De Ligt?
Oh, that's a really tough question. That's a really tough question, because I'm on record saying that Pogba back at Juventus would be a complete success, a complete success. I think he'd pick up form from where he left off at Juventus. I think Pogba would instantly be a top, top player in the world again in a Juve shirt. But with that said, I've talked so much about how perfect it would be for Juventus if they got Matthijs de Ligt, because he is exactly what the doctor ordered when you think about moving on from the BBC, when you're talking about the rich history Juventus has with their defenders, and not just their defenders being great defenders, but their defenders being leaders. And then you get somebody who does not come around very often, David, in De Ligt, somebody that is not just a great defender. He is a great young leader. And for people out there who have been hearing a lot about De Ligt, but you haven't really dipped your toe into who he is, watch some of the clips of this kid. I mean, David, it's tough to call him a kid. He is, sometimes I feel like he's a Spartan and he's leading his people out to battle. I mean, he's absolutely incredible when he talks, and I don't think he would have any problem kind of carrying the torch from that contingent, that BBC grouping. So I just think he would be so perfect for Juventus on and off the pitch that I am going to edge closer to say De Ligt would be the more impactful signing, but just by a hair, because if they get Pogba, that would be a complete success, because like I keep saying, I'm sounding like a broken record, but their biggest area for improvement, in my opinion, is the midfield. And I think Pogba would just be a fabulous addition, but De Ligt, nah, that would be incredible this next year and incredible, David, for 10 plus years probably. So I would edge closer to De Ligt. But as you said before you posed this question to me, now that I've spewed a little bit on it, what is the reality of the situation with De Ligt and Juventus?
So look, I know Juve fans often speak badly at Raiola, but I think, you know, you look at the history of Juve in recent years, he's been incredibly impactful. And I think if De Ligt didn't have Raiola as his agent, there's no way Juve would be back in the race. So just to recap last few weeks on De Ligt, we started, you know, the summer transfer window. I was convinced he was going to Barcelona, made a lot of sense in many ways, but Barcelona didn't agree to give him a huge salary, nor Raiola's commission. There was a little bit of interest from Man United, but honestly, it seemed more like Raiola trying to use him to drive the price. We had Leonardo join PSG, and right after, strong news of PSG being in the lead for De Ligt. But now Juve this week, and I wonder if the fact that they're pretty optimistic that they're going to sign Rabiot on a Bosman, I wonder if with that they're saying, you know what? We have Rabiot, we have Sean, had a good second half of the season, we have Ramsey, we have Sarri, spoke highly of Pjanic. Maybe our midfield is in good shape there. Let's spend the money on the defense. And they are offering De Ligt a huge salary, like with bonuses, 11 to 12 million, which at Juve, to give you perspective, Ronaldo's at 30. The highest earner beyond that is at 8. So a big step forward for such a young player. There's talk of potentially a release clause. But Juve looks in the driver's seat to get him. And that would be a really strong addition. And I agree with you. As much as I like the idea of Pogba at Juve, for me, Juve's defense already, you have Barzagli retiring. I think Chiellini got hurt at the worst possible time. Bonucci wasn't very good defensively, so I think this is a great move by Juve. I know people are concerned there could be this release clause, but it's more about carpe diem. I think De Ligt would be absolutely great addition for him. So we're recording this on Monday afternoon. As of now, it looks pretty optimistic, but let's not count out PSG out of this one altogether either.
Yeah, and it's interesting, David. I know as much as people care about De Ligt and the sweepstakes for De Ligt, people care more about what team will Alex Goldberg become a fan of in Serie A, understandably so. Now, if De Ligt goes to Juventus, I don't know. I hate to be one of those people that just piles on to the best team in the league, but they still have my boy Alexandro, and I've loved De Ligt, you know, for a while.
Yeah.
Before he necessarily became everyone's cup of coffee, cup of tea. So it's going to be hard for me not to root for a battery that has De Ligt and Alexandro back there, but we'll see. We'll see. All right, David. So kind of staying on Matthias De Ligt and staying on Juventus in general, let's talk about some hot transfer topics as we've been doing before we get to an interview and Twitter questions. So we talk about De Ligt, we talk about Pogba. I guess the logical question would be, could Juventus afford both?
Well, look, you know, take it with a grain of salt. I didn't think Juve could afford Ronaldo until the day it happened. And then when I said Juve bought Ronaldo, now they're going to have to sell some big names. They didn't end up having to really do that. They sold a lot of young players for plusvalenza throughout the year. So never say never. But when I look at these two specifically, it's not just the transfer fee. And you're talking over $220 million on the conservative side for both of them. You're talking about humongous salaries. Pogba and De Ligt combined salaries would be like $25 million after taxes, $50 million or so before taxes, and on top of that, huge commissions on both for Mino Raiola, who, as close as he is to Juve, does not work for free. So no, I'd be very surprised. And again, I wonder if Juve going back in on De Ligt has to do with Rabiot and them feeling pretty good about him on a Bosman, and even him on a Bosman, like that would be far from free because we know the commissions and the salary. The last thing I want to say about this is, you know, I know Ronaldo's been getting a lot of agent 007 buzz on the De Ligt thing because he told them to come to Juve. Look, I'm not diminishing that being a factor. I could imagine for a young player like De Ligt, who's watched Ronaldo his whole life, like that's got to be powerful. But Juve's been after him for a long time. We've talked about it on the podcast. He visited their facilities last year. Juve should have closed the deal back then. We know their relationship with Raiola. So Ronaldo definitely, I would say, is a small factor, but by no means is this something that started just a few weeks ago.
It would be hard for me to turn down Ronaldo if he told me to do anything, let's be real. You know, it's getting to the point where the De Ligt sweepstakes are making the Sarri sweepstakes or the Sarri saga seem like nothing. I mean, this has gone on for a long, long time. You can argue before the season ended, because when Frankie de Jong went to Barca, that kind of started the De Ligt story. So, man, this has been very interesting and a long story. But if there's any player, if there's any young player that deserves it, I think it's him. And it's refreshing, David, that it's a center back. So often it's a striker or a winger or maybe an attacking midfielder. I like that this is over a center back. I do think that's positive for football. Now, let's move from Juventus to maybe their most formidable threat to take away the Scudetto, and that is Inter with Antonio Conte. David, what did you make of Inter acquiring Sassuolo midfielder Sensi?
Came a little bit out of the blue. I think this is a move that is financial almost as much as a sporting move. In many ways, this was the photocopy of the Politano deal last year, a substantial loan fee. I think in this case, $5 million, an option to buy set at $22 to $25 million, plus a young player going from Inter's Primavera to Sassuolo. So really a photocopy of what we saw for Politano. The reason I say a financial move, a very underrated aspect of this deal, is the Primavera striker going from Inter to Sassuolo. He's going to be a pure plusvalenza profit right now for Inter, which they'll be using for the June 30th deadline to meet their financial fair play parameters. So they get relief there. Take more than a flyer on Sensi. They are paying a good amount for the loan. And then if it works out, they'll redeem his rights like they did with Politano. I think it's a pretty good move. I think Sensi, especially if he's coming to replace what Inter was getting from Borja Valero, that's a really, really good deal. So more of a bench player. He is a pretty good fit. If Conte goes 3-5-2 as the midfielder in front of the defense, I think since he is a pretty good player, goes with an Italian nucleus with Gagliardini, and it doesn't prevent them from getting Barella, who's going to come too. So overall, I think a good move, but also there were certainly some financial aspects on this one that were a little bit underrated.
I'll be honest, I don't dislike the player, but I was kind of hoping Inter would take Mateo Kovacic just to make things a lot clearer for Chelsea, but I guess that's probably not going to happen. So, all right, there's a player who's tearing it up for the Spain U21 team, and he, of course, is a member of Real Madrid, but rightfully so, a little bit down in their pecking order, David. So from a Milan perspective, what are the odds that they can sign Ceballos?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because, you know, historically, Milan and Real Madrid have had a great relationship. Granted, it's no longer Galliani, but now you have Boban and Maldini. They traveled to Madrid, met with them. We talked a little bit about it, and Ceballos is one of the targets. It'll be interesting because Real Madrid, I would imagine, has spent a lot. They want to make, you know, some money back to not get in trouble with FFP down the line. Would they prefer to sell Ceballos? Probably. I'm not sure Milan can afford him now beyond the loan with an option to buy. Milan's situation is a little bit unclear because of their appeal. They're trying to maybe not play in the Europa League to get an extra year to balance the book. So it's hard to say how strict their parameters are. I know Ceballos been also linked to Spurs. So let's see what happens. I think it would be a great move for Milan. While we're on the topic, we're recording this on Monday. They are making, they're trying to sign the Turkish defender Kabak, who we talked about last week. Our friend Emre at Turkish Football is a big fan of his, so Milan met with him again, but they are competing with Bayern Munich to sign him. Milan can, of course, offer him more playing time, but as I said last week, I'm very curious to see where that leaves Caldara at Milan. So interesting times at Milan. Not surprising to see them targeting these young players with upside.
Yeah, I like that. I certainly like that from a Milan perspective. And Ceballos seems like a really nice player. I mean, I've known of him for a little while, but it seems like he's really becoming something. So that would be very exciting for them. All right, so something else that would be exciting for a certain team is the acquiring of two players we've been talking about now for a couple episodes. So, David, what's the latest on Napoli's pursuit of James Rodriguez and Kostas Manolas?
Yeah, very exciting. You know, when you were saying earlier that Inter looked like the biggest challenger to Juve, I pictured all of our Napoli listeners who are rightfully really pumped about their team. I got to say, you add these two, I'm going to give him a slight edge on Inter. We have to see what else happens. So with Manolas, looks very promising. Manolas has told Roma he wants to go to Napoli. Because he has that exit clause, you know, it's a matter of how Napoli, they're just going to pay for it or try to include a player or sell a player to a third team. But looks like Manolas is very, very realistic. There's a lot of reporters in Naples who are very plugged in with the team, who are very confident on Rodriguez coming as well. Di Marzio on Friday sounded pretty optimistic as well. So I think there's a pretty good chance they're going to get both, definitely Manolas. And interestingly, today, Napoli's Twitter account had an interesting tweet on, you know, Gazzetta dello Sport, you know, publishing rumors that Allan and Insigne could be sold. And they tweeted, it's the biggest BS so far of the summer. They're not for sale. But then they also added, we haven't received a fair offer for their value. And should those arrive, we'll evaluate them. So it was pretty interesting tweet. I find Napoli being colorful to be pretty hilarious and on brand. But let's see what happens. I really get the vibe that Napoli are going to do similar to 2 years ago when they tried to go all in for the Scudetto. I think they're going to try to keep the gang together. Now, I do think at least one between Allan or Insigne will be sold, but I think they're going to go all in this year, and I think it makes sense from Juve going from Allegri to Sarri. I think at least in Serie A there is a chance for an opening. So good for them for going all in. So next up, I'm very excited. We've been wanting to have a real Donald J. Agnelli on the podcast for quite some time. For those of you not familiar with him, check out the Twitter account. Really pretty hilarious. So we wanted to get his very unique perspective on what's been happening at Juve. We wanted to specifically talk about the Sarri hire with him directly. So I have to say, we've had a very impressive run of guests. We've had quite the range of guests, but not quite as exciting as who I'm about to introduce next. This Twitter account has taken over. It's become incredibly popular for very good reasons. So we are very excited to be joined by the transfer man himself, Mr. Donald J. Agnelli. So, Mr. President, we are humbled to have you on Calcioland, as we would say in Italy. Benvenuto.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me here. I am very excited to be here. You have a tremendous show. I am honored to help give you the greatest ratings you've ever seen. Many people who have never, ever watched soccer or even heard of Serie A before, are going to be talking about you now. Believe me.
Well, Mr. President, we are very humbled by this. So let me ask you, the past month has been dominated by your search for Juve's next coach. While everyone, and I mean everyone for a long time, was expecting Pep Guardiola to come in, you swooped in and went with Maurizio Sarri. So tell us a little bit about your decision here, Mr. President.
Maurizio Sarri, big, beautiful Mo, as I know him. He's a very, very great coach. I wanted him from the very beginning. He was my number one choice. He has a very state-of-the-art way of coaching. He uses drones. He loves them way more than even Obama did. And his teams play a very beautiful, very luxurious brand of football. While he was at Napoli, I mean, let's face it, he was a loser. But it wasn't his fault. He just couldn't beat my beautiful Juventus, which, let's face it, I built the greatest teams that Serie A has ever seen. Once he left that loser city, he suddenly won the European League, proving he's a winner, as long as he's not in a loser environment like Naples. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. President. So let me ask you, what do you make about the fact that after there were a lot of public denials, some from your assistant transfer man, Paratici, from Pep Guardiola himself, from Manchester City officially. But let me ask you, what do you make of the fact that the media was still reporting that you were really had Pep as your top choice?
Well, David, and I know, I'm no stranger to the media being fake. They first started reporting that I was going to hire Antonio Conte, who I call Bald Tony to his face. He thinks he's very tough, but he's actually very weak mentally and physically, and I fired him years ago. No way I would hire him back. As for Pep, he's a very nice man, not Juve material. Pep came to me after Allegri was fired like a dog, and honestly, Pep is a very good friend, David, and he said, and David, he was crying, I kid you not, and Pep's a very big, very strong man, and he was crying, and he said, Mr. Agnelli, please hire me. I want to work with you. I want to win for you. I want to come to Turin, and I want to train with your beautiful Cantinese. And then he said, you don't even have to pay me. David, true story, offered to work for free because he wanted to work with us so badly. But Pep, I said, and he has a very beautiful bald head, David, I said, I'm not ready. I thought he was too mentally weak. From day one, I knew that Sarri was the greatest coach in the world, so I hired him. The media kept lying to sell papers, but I give it straight to the people, so I do. Thank you.
So next thing I want to ask you, Mr. President, is we knew there was going to be the rollout of Sarri's press conference on Thursday. There was news that Napoli might try to upstage your big introductory press conference for your coach by bringing in Rodriguez. That didn't happen, but there still was a lot of folklore and quite the reaction in Naples. So what do you think about the way Napoli, the city, the club, and the fans have handled the fact that you hired their former coach, Sarri?
Well, first of all, the deals keep coming for us, and notice James Rodriguez, nowhere to be found near Naples, first of all. Second of all, David, I'm used to the haters. When you win as much as I do, people are going to be jealous. They're going to hate. I have been hated in Naples for years, but really, they love me because nobody has done more for Italy, especially for the Southerners, than I have. And nobody has done more for Calcio. Every team is doing better now because of how successful I made for Juventus. Nobody has done more than me. Before I took over, Juventus was a total disaster, a complete joke. We were a laughingstock, and so was Italy. We didn't win anymore. Now all we do is win. And as far as Naples goes, I took their favorite son, the only person who has ever come out of that city and passed the Coverciano course to become a coach, and I'm going to make him into an actual winner, and he can finally win the Scudetto. Wouldn't be able to do it without me. So really, I'm doing more for the city of Naples than anyone ever has, even that disgusting slob, Diego Maradona. So they love me. Thank you.
So let's talk about the other team who's trying to keep up with you, Mr. President. And this is Inter, and they've been taking some of your former managers at the both on the front office and on the pitch. So tell me a little bit, how concerned are you of what Inter are doing?
David, not at all concerned about Inter. I fired Giuseppe Marotta, sleepy, creepy guy, because he was too low energy for his job. I fired Baldoni because he's too much of a hothead and has far too low of an IQ to coach a great team like Juventus. The only way Inter has ever won anything is by being the crooked Inter that everyone knows they are. They'll still try to be crooked, believe me. But the people leading them are too dumb to make it work. Thank you.
Well, Mr. President, we know you're really, really busy this time of year, so we don't want to take too much of your time. But we have to ask, people are in awe of your ability to continuously pull off deals, incredible deals, I would say. So what's the secret? I mean, what makes the transfer man like you so successful?
Deals are my art form. I like making deals, preferably big ones. For example, Mathis De Ligt, a very strong, very tough young man represented by my very good friend, Mino Ravioli. You have to develop very good relationships with some very important people. Mino is a fine family man. He was wrongfully banned, total witch hunt by the corrupt Italian authorities. Well, I helped him out. He won his appeal, and he's a free man today because of me, and now he's helping me sign his most sought-after client. The system is corrupt because billionaires can buy access to transfers, and as president of ECA, I will fix it and drain the swamp with my beautiful Champions League reform, and we're going to make Serie A, we're going to make Europe, we're going to make everything great again. Thank you.
Well, Mr. President, we can't thank you enough for coming on. Keep making deals. We love covering your great work, and thank you for helping Calcioland further develop their brand by gracing us with your presence.
Tremendous, David. Thank you.
Well, all right. That was a momentous Calcioland interview for sure. Well, let's move a whole different direction now, and let's move to our Twitter questions, which are just fantastic all year round, but especially during the transfer window. All right, David, first question. Is De Rossi wanting to play for another Serie A team a worse indictment of the club's management than Totti's press conference?
In some ways, yes, but it's kind of what I mentioned earlier. I really feel like these events are like connected, and De Rossi being told you can't come back next season generated the press conference, and then the press conference generated De Rossi saying, screw it, I'll just play for another team. But what it really did is Roma's been in a really tough PR situation. We've talked about it last week briefly. To me, you can't win a public relations battle out in the fans' view against Totti. If you're Roma, the club really hasn't tried. Good for them, but they are taking a lot of blows. So I think De Rossi just feels like, you know, the time is right, that people would not hold it against him as much if he goes to play for another team. I think De Rossi looks at the fact that the fans are so disgusted with the ownership that they'll forgive me, they'll blame them when they see me in another jersey. So yeah, I think this has certainly escalated the situation and made it worse for sure.
All right, that was an interesting question. Next question, David. Is the role of a bandiera overemphasized in Italy?
So the bandiera, you know, is the symbol of the team, preferably someone from the city. So obviously Totti, De Rossi, you know, Maldini grew up on Milan's youth team, so he's a bandiera del Piero, although he came up on my Padova before going to Juve as a bandiera. So someone you identify with the club. And it's an interesting question. Like, the first thing that I thought of is the interview we did with Gino De Blasio when we were talking about racism in Italy and how everyone identifies with, like, the region and being very parochial and attached, not so much to your country, but to your city. And I think that's really why the role of the bandiera becomes maybe more important in Italy than in other places, because of the strong regional identification. So I think in some ways it's not a good thing. You know, without getting too political, I really could argue both cases. So I can see why this phenomenon is stronger in Italy than other places. And I can really argue both sides on if it's a good thing or not. But long and short of it, to me, in Italy, this is a bigger thing than, say, in England, Spain, or other places.
Huh. Okay. David, we've talked about the Napoli side of Manolas, but who do you see Roma replacing him with?
So they've been linked to Bartra, the former Dortmund center back who plays in Spain now. That's one name. The other is Atalanta center back Mancini. I wonder, though, because they've had changes in the front office. They've had a strong relationship with Atalanta before. I would imagine new sporting director Petracchi would have no problem doing a deal there. I thought Mancini played well when I watched them with the under 21. Obviously, losing Manolas is tough for Roma because even with Manolas staying, they needed at least one strong center back. And they're going to need two. So a tough situation. So hopefully they can sign at least one of those two, if not both.
Okay. David, I don't mean to laugh at this question, not at all. But is there a light at the end of the tunnel for John Solano and Roma fans?
It's a rough period, I have to say. And I'm glad you mentioned John, because a lot of people asked me to bring him back on our podcast. But it feels like, you know, if we invited John every time there's a crisis at Roma, I mean, he almost is like a host of the show. So what I did instead is I went on his podcast this weekend. I'm sure it'll be out soon. So quick word of support to John. I know he's getting a lot of abuse online as being a Pallotta apologist. I definitely don't think that's the case. Also, knowing John, he is someone who works a lot with sources for his site, and he's not afraid, trust me, of going after people who feed him stuff. So I'm going to show support to John. I know it's a rough period for Roma, but don't take it out on him. So, you know, is there light at the end of the tunnel? It's hard to say. I mean, Fonseca, their new manager, was introduced today. The club is trying to move away from older players, maybe trying to get away from being a team so identified with the city of Rome, maybe be more global and whatnot. So, you know, it's a rough period. I will say if one reason for hope for me, Roma is the midfield still has a lot of talent. Pellegrini has done well at the under 21. I'm still a fan of Zaniolo, although his star seems to have faded a little bit. Cristante came on. So I think there is some hope for Roma, but certainly it's a tough period. Not only do you see, you know, the club struggling with their legends, you see Napoli, Inter being so aggressive. So it might be a tough transition for Roma, but maybe they'll take one step back to take two forward.
All right. Here's an interesting question, David. What is the basis of the thought that Ronaldo and Dybala are not compatible, and do you think it can be resolved?
Well, I think the thought where it comes from is that it didn't work last season, at least certainly not for Dybala. For his standards, he really had a dreadful season. Now, is this something that's definitely going to continue to be the case? But I think Sarri's the perfect manager to try to figure it out. Dybala's kind of an odd player. Like, to me, I always thought he's best with a two striker formation next to a tall, strong striker like Mandzukic. He had a very good season at Juve that way. He's just not really a winger. He's not really exactly a trequartista. So I'm curious if Sarri tries to use him in the false nine role that worked really well for Mertens, and with Ronaldo more on the wing. That doesn't have to be a permanent thing. Maybe they spend, you know, 40 minutes of a match playing that style. But I think, you know, Dybala on paper is certainly one of the big winners of Juve hiring Sarri.
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens with Maurizio Sarri and all of those players. All right, David, how about this? For the same price, would you rather have Pogba or Milinkovic-Savic?
So we've had this variation of this question before, and this is just a good reminder. The reason we're doing it again is don't just look at transfer fees. Like, wages are really like a huge, huge part of this. So if Pogba and Milinkovic-Savic, say Pogba went for 150 million and Milinkovic-Savic hypothetically for 100 million, or say both went for the same price, with Pogba, you're paying astronomically more in wages, never mind agent commission, because unlike Milinkovic-Savic, Pogba has Raiola. So, look, I think they're pretty close players, all things considered, because of the cost of the wages. I could live with, as much as I love Pogba, I would go with Milinkovic-Savic just because of the cost. But this is a good reminder this time of year, don't just look at the transfer fee. The wages are equally important, and in some cases, even more important.
Okay. All right. Personal question here comes from our guy, Tone Ortiz. And he's asking you, David, after your chat last week with Dre Cordero, he's been wondering if social media has had more of a positive or a negative effect on the game.
Curious to get your perspective, Alex. I've been thinking a lot about this question since yesterday. And thank you, Tone, for your support. We always appreciate getting your questions. So here's where I landed. To me, at the end, it is better. Social media, access to more information. I think it makes it better. But, and it's a big but, it has to be curated appropriately. Like, I'll give you an example. I'm old. This time of year, you know, I grew up in Italy. I'd spend a lot of my summers in the U.S. with my grandparents. I had to go fetch a three-day-old Gazzetta dello Sport in New York City to figure out what was going on with transfers. Nowadays, I can follow experts on transfers on my phone. If I want to learn about a specific league or a specific team, there are fantastic Twitter accounts by people who, out of passion, cover teams. Like, you could learn things that back in the day were absolutely impossible. I think teams, clubs, players have used social media in brilliant ways to promote themselves, promote the game. But, and this is a big but, there's also a lot of negative stuff. And I'm not just talking about the trolling and that stuff. I mean, that's really horrible in and of itself. But even like misinformation, like I remember, Alex, I think it was 3 weeks ago or now, we were talking on the podcast about this news that supposedly Di Marzio had said that Allegri was the top choice for Chelsea because a Twitter account had posted that. Like, stuff like that happens all the time nowadays. And I saw Sid Lowe also had this great tweet how, you know, aggregators just take news from each other. So a Spanish paper will read an obscure English site, then people quote the Spanish paper, and all of a sudden it becomes a legit rumor. There's also a lot of noise, a lot of negativity. I say it all the time. That's kind of like my new pet peeve. Like, social media, media in general, like, they know if people are outraged, they will stay online more because they're upset. They'll want to engage. They have strong feelings about something that equals good ratings. And that is a problem. And I try to really be sensitive to that when news emerges. So long and short of it, I still think it's better. But you really have to curate it and try to set it up in a way where you're not being misinformed, you're not being abused, and that's not necessarily either. So that's where I landed on this. I'm very curious to hear the perspective of a younger guy than me, Alex, and someone who's really blowing up now. So what's your take on all this?
Well, I could certainly just say, well, that's great, because I've obviously had fun the last year or so doing social media, covering football, but I don't think it's that black and white at all. And if it's good for me or bad for me, it could be completely different for the next person. I do think overall it's good. And if I take Tone's question really literally, and he writes on the game specifically, I think it's definitely more good than bad, because social media can definitely get really hypey. I'm kind of making up a word, but when there's a player that's doing well or a young player, and I've been guilty of this, you can really hype them up a lot. But specifically on the game, I've learned that the players who are really supposed to make it are going to make it. And even talking to some players, I realized that I can hype them up all I want. It's really not going to have an impact of when they get on the pitch. Now, for a couple players, David, it will. Maybe your Alvaro Morata's when things are going poorly. But for the most part, I don't think social media has a immense negative effect on the game versus the positive effect. Now, of course, when a player is going poorly, social media can get nasty towards that player, but there have always been different forms of that. In fact, there used to be even more dangerous forms of that. So I think from the game specifically, I think social media definitely turns out some really good stuff. And David, it turns out the ability for players to connect with fans. I mean, I think that's something that's been really, really positive. Yeah. Is you find so many of these players, even older players who have Instagram and have Snapchat and have Twitter, just really connecting with fans. I mean, from a Chelsea perspective, John Terry does Q&As on Instagram and he just can answer your question right there and then. So I think all that stuff is really, really cool. Now, when we kind of broaden it up, like you were talking about, I do hate the copy and paste of reporting. I hate the he said, she said type thing. And yeah, during transfer windows, it can be absolute madness. And we've been talking about this a lot, about how people get extra toxic when they find people reporting stuff they don't want to hear. So you're spot on. You got to curate it. You got to really figure out who you trust, who you like, and whittle it down, simplify, or else it will swallow you whole. I mean, I can't imagine, David, if I just sat down and I didn't have a Twitter account, right? And I just sat down and maybe I tweeted to people, who should I follow if I'm interested in football? Oh, it would be such a headache. So you definitely have to learn who to trust, who you like, who brings a balance of positivity and negativity. And yeah, you got to curate it. But overall, I do think it is more positive than negative, but it's close. It's certainly close. You got to use it the way that you truly want to use it and not the way others want to use it. That's important. So, David, this is an interesting question. Next Twitter question is, what should be the criteria when picking a favorite team in a league?
Yeah, we've talked about this one before, but there's another factor that comes to mind now. So I think, you know, if you have like a geographical or family tie to a team, like if your father and your grandfather, someone supported a team, or you originally your ancestors, your grandparents came from a certain city and you feel an affiliation to that, I think that's great. I'm in favor of that. We're talking about the bandiera factor before, but I think if you have a connection that transcends the players in the moment, it's better, because as we've seen, players come and go. I think too, you know, if you get, if you fall in love with a player at an international tournament, like say you watched the under 21 tournament or you watch the World Cup and you fall in love with a player, I think then that's a fine reason to support the club. But again, there's a chance that the player will leave or whatnot. Then I think, you know, certain clubs have certain tradition and certain values. Some live up to them maybe more than others. And I think that should be part of it. But I think at the end of the day, it really is like a visceral connection, something that you can't really put your finger on. It's like, you know, falling in love with like a beautiful woman or something like that. Like it just happens. Like I think that's the best connection when it's something visceral like that. So that's my take. Alex, have you changed your position on this? How do you feel about this one?
No, I definitely have not changed my position. I don't think a lot of thinking should go into picking a favorite team. It's got to feel like a seamless fit. It's really got to feel like when you try on clothes. I mean, I think sometimes if you're on the fence, right, you're putting on a pair of pants and it says it's your size, but it just doesn't feel like it should feel. Well, don't think to yourself, well, if I wash it, maybe it'll fit better. Or, maybe it'll fit better at home or with a different pair of underwear. No. If you're kind of on the fence about it and you have to rationalize it, maybe it's not the perfect fit for you. You should just know. And yeah, that's my stance on all of it.
Okay. I'm very excited to be joined by one of our regular guests, someone who's been on the Couch-O-Land journey with us since we started, our dear friend, Richard Hall. You guys by now know that he's a chief correspondent for Football Italia, where he covers a lot of topics in calcio with a strong focus on Inter and Milan. In the interview, we'll chat mainly about them. He's also the creator of one of my favorite websites. I still catch myself reading some of the articles on there, Gentleman Ultra, which covers, you know, not just calcio, but also the culture around calcio. He's also, of course, been featured in Guardian Sport. Here in the U.S., you can hear him on Sirius XMFC frequently talking about calcio. So, Richard, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Welcome back to Calcioland.
Thanks, David. It's always good being back on your show. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, Richard. So, before we get to Milan and Inter, because I want to ask you about what's going on there, let's talk briefly about the under 21, Italy's under 21 team. So we're recording this before we know if they're going to get out the group stage or not. It's out of their control. They've played three matches with different degrees of success. So let me ask you, there was, I think rightfully, a lot of hype on this team, definitely a lot of talent. And I'm not one who gets too excited about young players, but this team definitely loaded. So let me ask you, on the three games we've seen so far, which Azzurrini players stood out to you the most and why?
I think this under 21 team is really interesting, and there's a right that people were so optimistic about and, you know, had so many hopes for them, just because when you look at the likes of all the way through the team. You look at the likes of Pellegrini and Bastoni. You know, just let's start with Bastoni. I think that he's such a promising player. And you've got players like that who are then, and Mancini, of course, as well, who are then mixed with the more established names. I mean, the players who look like they may go for big money this season or next, the likes of Chiesa, the likes of Barella, the likes of Pellegrini. You know, you can really see that nice mix. And it seems as though the strength in depth is so much now that... you know, you thought they would go a long way in this competition. Looking at the team at the moment, it's difficult because when you look at Gigi DiBiagio and his tactics and how he's looked at it, I know that he's come under a lot of criticism, and I think rightly so. But in some, I think the frustration is in some games. I mean, if you look at the game against Spain, they were outplayed in the early part of that, but their somewhat physical approach got them back into it. I thought they played some of the best football actually against Poland. They pressed well. They played with intensity and a bit of purpose, and there's quality there as well. But again, you know, you're looking, there's not a consistency, there's not a clear idea from the coach. And I think that at the moment is sort of highlighting that the how fallible they are. Young players like this, at an international level, you know, they need to be able to have a clear idea that set up. The coach hasn't got a long time with them. Sometimes it may look a bit more basic, but they need to be able to go out and take on these teams in a set manner. And that set manner should realistically resonate all the way through from the top, from the Azzurri right down to the under-16s. My overall take on this is whilst, you know, I think you look at Chiesa, he looks a different class. He's been my pick probably, which is an obvious pick, but there's a reason that he's an obvious pick. It's because he's so good. But the overall frustration with this tournament is just that I feel that it's been slightly wasted. There's not been consistency. You can really take individual parts of each game and praise them. But again, you know, I just don't feel, and it's the only way I feel that this team's going to go really deep into this competition is on moments of individual brilliance rather than a cohesive approach.
Yep, absolutely. So I wanted to talk to you. Let's transition to the two clubs in Milano. Let's start with Inter. I wanted to ask you, it's not official yet, but it's all but done. Inter are set to acquire Stefano Sensi from Sassuolo. So let me ask you, what did you make of this decision as a whole? You know, they've had a success with the Politano deal last year. They have Gagliardini already in the midfield. It's a good chance Barella's coming next, so they have an Italian nucleus. So tell me a little bit what you make of the pursuit of Sensi and how you think he fits into the team.
It's energy. Energy and quality for me. I think Sensi's got both of those attributes. You know, he's in the Conte mold as well, realistically. You look at the way Inter, like you mentioned, setting up, there is that sort of Italian core that he's wanting. You know, we know what he's going to play. It's going to be that variation of the 3-5-2. Yes, it'll be different in some games, but generally it'll be in the same mold. I think it's really interesting that already he's put out the sort of the edict that even the younger Primavera teams will be adopting a 3-5-2. For me, he's coming in here to put a real Conte stamp on it. You could say with the likes of Beppe Marotta there as well, is that a little, is he trying to replicate what he did when he was first at Juve, potentially, but it worked for him. You know, he's won a league title in England doing the same thing. I think that, you know, Inter fans in general will appreciate this season, even if it tends to be a transitional one. They have got an opportunity with the right Mercato that, you know, this is the season to potentially catch Juventus, or at least to try and gain some ground. But I think that over the past, when you look at the teams under, whether it's, if we take De Boer out of this scenario, because that was just a mitigated disaster, really. You look at the likes of Pioli, you look at Spalletti, you look at Mancini, and those teams could be, even Mazzarri to the point, you know, you could even, low energy teams. You could tell what he was trying to do, but they lack creativity. The amount of times that Mauro Icardi bailed them out in so many different ways. And I think this will be different. I think that, you know, with players like Sensi, if Barella comes across, Gagliardini has got so much quality that wasn't utilised under Spalletti particularly well. I think that what you could see here is a team that, that they can really identify with, a team that's exciting. And potentially, you know, yeah, I think it's an exciting time.
Absolutely. So now let's talk. Obviously, Inter's going to have, they already had a great defense. They have Diego Godin coming in as well to go with Skriniar and De Vrij. So that area looks really, really strong. Brozovic, I thought, had a good season. If it were to be Barella and Sensi, when you look at the rest of the midfield, do you think that's enough, or do you think that's an area that Inter needs to look at further?
You know, it's, they are long seasons, you know, especially with Europe as well. So I think it's, you know, you could look down most sides at the moment, and I don't think many coaches would say, yeah, that's enough. I don't need any more players other than potentially Sarri. But it's, you know, you look at this squad now, and it always has been fairly strong. My interesting part of this, you know, you look at how he's going to use Nainggolan. I think that'd be quite interesting. I think, obviously, if he's playing that 3-5-2, you've got to start looking at the fullback positions and how he's going to change those around. You know, yes, you've got players like Alistair Perisic, Politano, who we mentioned, who, you know, you have to balance that as well. And when you look at balancing that maybe with someone like a Danilo D'Ambrosio, you think potentially is there something that can be upgraded there? Asamoah is obviously another option as well. But I think they do look to have the majority of what Conte needs at the moment. I think more than anything, it's going to be just how quickly he can secure his centre forwards. And because obviously he wants that target man, doesn't he? And that's going to be the key thing for him. So it just depends on, I think realistically, there's a huge, I mean, you'll know this better than me, David. I mean, I think there's a huge issue here that, you know, you read the Italian media and you see one train of thought that, listen, they need to get rid of Icardi before they can, it's a decent money before they can go out and start to spend, especially because for the end of June because of that 40 million they want to recoup. But in turn, you know, there's other reports, especially recently, that when Conte came back from his holiday in Ibiza, that he's saying, right, no, we need to go for Lukaku now. And that will be a message then to Icardi. So there's a lot surrounding that at the moment and just how much Inter are going to spend and can spend. But I think there's certain key components that he still needs in this squad. But overall, it's fairly strong.
Absolutely. So now let's talk about that front line, as you mentioned. Icardi, I'm going to take him off the table. That's a really rough situation. So let's kind of put him out of the equation and look at the rest. We have Lautaro Martinez, who I thought overall had a successful first season in Serie A. Dzeko seems to be the favorite in the short term to arrive. I think it's pretty likely that he arrives. So let me ask you, A, when you look at Dzeko and Lautaro Martinez as a duo or Dzeko as a mentor to Lautaro Martinez, how do you see that? And then also, we'll get into in a second, if you think Inter should make a substantial financial sacrifice to sign someone like Lukaku.
It is interesting. I mean, it's a good point you make about almost Dzeko being a bit of a mentor to Martinez. The interesting reason I say that is because Martinez was talking to an Argentinian journalist at the start of last season, and they were saying, you know, Martinez is someone who is very much in need of a role model as a person. You know, he looked at Milito back at Racing. He looked at Icardi as a player he wanted to emulate as well. Someone like Dzeko would be absolutely superb for him. I think, like you say, you know, Martinez had a great first season, I would say, because I think he is a bit more of a Conte type player because he plays for the team. I think, in some respects, I think he saw what Mauro Icardi was doing and thought, I'm not going to, you know, I might want to emulate how he, you know, how he finishes, but certainly not how he conducts himself. So that's quite interesting. Dzeko, I think, even at his age, is definitely an improvement. He's definitely someone you want in the squad. You're not going to expect him to do what he did at Roma in his heyday and score as many goals as that. But again, you know, he's one of those players who can hold the ball up, who can bring Martinez into the play. I do, though, do you think they are going to need more than that? I just think they're a bit more firepower, especially if Icardi is on his way out. And Romelu Lukaku, for me, I'd be really interested to see him play in Serie A. I just feel that the strength and power that he has would cause a lot of problems, but also as well, you know, what's really interesting is that I think there's quite a lot of creativity. Well, Conte, when he has his formation, will automatically create a little bit more creativity. And look at the difference between Lukaku for Manchester United and Lukaku for Belgium. You know, it's huge. So this guy's going to score goals no matter what. You know, even his record at United, it's not been particularly good this season, but it's still not bad. And I think he's in the right place with a team that's really, you know, looking like they're going to be on the up. I'd be interested to see him there. So it would be, I mean, I don't know how likely this is going to be and how quickly it's going to be, but it certainly looks as though he is the main option if they are going to spend.
Yeah, I'm equally intrigued by the possibility of seeing him at Inter. And very good point on the difference that we see with him playing for Belgium and Man United. Well said. So now let's talk a little bit about Milan. They've had they redid their front office once again. They have a fourth sporting director in 4 years. They have a team in charge there with Maldini, Boban, and Massara, and they made their big decision was bringing in Marco Giampaolo from Sampdoria as their manager. So let me ask you, what was your reaction to the hire? And do you think on paper, Giampaolo, tactically, at least from a strictly coaching perspective, could on paper be the best one Milan has had since Allegri left?
Yeah, I do. I really do, actually, because I think that when they've looked to, I understand what Milan have done in the past when they've tried to look, especially at former players, to try and get that Milan DNA, you know, and try and almost let people know that these players achieved with Milan. But not always, you know, the football and the finances haven't always conspired to be able to help them do that. I think that Giampaolo is the best coach for this, for one reason. Because of the situation they're in, you know, financially now, I mean, even Gazidis had said, listen, we need to temper our expectations. We are not going to be the Milan you all expect us to be. Well, we're going to go out and spend another 200 million in the summer. They are going to look to youth. It's a new dawn. And because of that, I think that, you know, what Giampaolo did at Sampdoria was excellent. I mean, he had that team with, you know, few resources, really, in comparison to some of the other major teams in the top half of that table. You know, he did a fantastic job, and they were enjoyable to watch. I think for Milan fans, that's what they're going to need. If they can have someone who's going to trust young players. Now, this all depends on whether the model works. And the reason I'm saying that with a bit of caution is because in theory, it sounds fantastic. If they can say to their supporters, it's a long-term project. Yeah, as I said before, you know, as Gazidis has said, we're going to buy youth players. We're not going to sell our best players, but we're going to spend the money on players and develop them into what they're going to become. I think it's an interesting model that, you know, I think a lot of teams are looking around and thinking, even though Atalanta did do it on youth, they're looking at teams like Atalanta, they're looking at people like Sassuolo and thinking, hold on, these teams have had success without spending all this money. So I do think that, I've said it on here before, Italy's youth systems are terribly underused, really, really badly. And so, for you know, you look at, I mean, everyone takes the example of Ajax, and it's not something Milan are trying to imitate in that way, but they can look to their youth systems and promote from within. They've had success in the past with this, even if it's been through fluke in the past, you know, where they've had to promote players when they were in trouble last time after Berlusconi. Money was running dry. So yeah, I think he is the right man. The only cautionary tale with this though is Gazidis has said this before with Arsenal, when he almost said, you know, listen, if you can do this until the stadium is built, we won't sell our best players, and when the stadium's up and paid for, we'll be able to compete with Bayern Munich, his famous words, which has come back to haunt him. But it's interesting with Milan at the moment, and as long as they stick to the plan, I think they could be okay.
Okay. Well, I have to ask you, Richard, before I ask you on your take on Sarri to Juve. We're recording this on Monday. Today there was the news that Milan chairman Scaroni said that they're going to build a new stadium near the old one and that San Siro will be demolished and there'll be a new building in its place. So I want to get your reaction to this. I'm going to tell you, I personally, I'll believe it when I see it. I think I've heard this a million times. But let me ask you your take on San Siro. as a whole? Do you think this time it's legit that they're going to move away? And what's your reaction to the news in general? I know you've been there many times and you have strong affection for the place, as do I.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been going, I can't think, you know, maximum I did probably was about 8 times in 1 year, ever since 2006. And this place is somewhere that, you know, the my love of football comes from Italia 90 and watching that opening game there and the little snippets even before that when I was 8-9 years old watching Inter and little clips of Inter and Milan, you know, and Eurosport and different things. So, and yeah, it, I mean, I've had so many phone calls today. I say that you're okay about this news, but I'm a bit similar to yourself. Italian bureaucracy, you know, they've got to get past that first. So this could, you know, this could be, I could be retired before this even happens. But it's sad in some ways. I think what frustrates me a little bit about it is I understand there has to be progress. Italian football really does need to progress, and that hugely is involved around the stadiums and the way they sell their merchandise, the way they market themselves. You know, you look at the likes of Udinese, they've done well, and even though the council owns that land and they tried to move that stadium forward, you know, the local authorities obviously own San Siro. And so it's going to be interesting. They're still saying that stadium's going to be up till 2026, the mayor was saying before, wasn't he? Because of the potential bid of the Winter Olympics. So you can see the problems already. On a personal note, though, I think that there's certain stadiums. I mean, when you look at the Delle Alpi, you know, it was built for that World Cup. It was the wrong thing to do. You could say that about San Nicola as well. But there are certain stadiums that it's like if you had the 7-8 wonders of the world, whatever it is, you know, there should be stadiums that have that sort of stature. And San Siro is one. For me, you don't change a San Siro, you don't change a Bombonera. But that's me being probably a little too nostalgic. I would have preferred to see them modify it. I think if they build a new stadium, I still want to see it. It'll pay homage at least to the old San Siro. But on the flip side, you know, this is not my point. My brother said to me, you know, we thought that when Bayern moved out of the Olympic Stadium, you know, they'd won in 74 in the World Cup there. And you remember all these Bayern teams, and now we don't even think about it. So, you know, maybe progress is progress. For me, though, it's very personally sad.
Yeah. But I'll believe it when I see it because Italy is in Germany, but let's see what happens. So before I let you go, I know we wanted to focus more on Inter and Milan, but I have to ask you on Sarri to Juve, which is really quite the story in and of itself. So give me your reaction to the hire of overall, if you think it's a good thing. And also give me your reaction to the press conference, because I have to say I'm very impressed that how Juve and Sarri have really turned the narrative. There was a lot of really upset people. And from where I'm sitting, it seems like they did a good job messaging-wise. So give me your take on Sarri to Juve and the rollout of his arrival.
I think what's really interesting about this is when I first thought about it, I assumed that Sarri was coming to coach Juve that we all know. The you that we grew up with, you know, which makes me, in that case, it makes no sense. And because at first I thought, hold on a second, you know, we all know Juve's motto is just simply to win at all costs. Sarri wants to play attractive football. It's not his philosophy. That's not his mantra. Juve have an element of professionalism about their coaches, a bit of class, the way that they portray themselves. And Sarri's not that. And my biggest fear for Sarri was, how does a very excellent coach, but who's 60 years old, of course, somewhat, some say, stuck in his ways, how does someone like that, the former banker, come through the ranks and then coach Cristiano Ronaldo? Because you can't coach Cristiano Ronaldo. So all of these different things, where I was thinking, it just seemed like the most bizarre fit possible. And, you know, I thought it's going to be a bit of a disaster waiting to happen because, you know, the ties to Napoli and all the things that have been said before, you know, what if he doesn't start to win straight away? How do Juve cope with that? And, you know, how do the players react to that? But, as you said, the press conference, things that have happened since, the fact that he's been to see Ronaldo on holiday and start to talk to him about his role, the way it's being handled, You could argue here that it's the beginning of a huge change. I mean, we've seen Juventus change their stadium. We've seen them change their badge. We've seen them change their kit. Now it's changing the coach and the philosophy and the tactics. This is the new Juventus. This is where Juventus want to be. It's a step above. You know, we always think this is probably why Juventus is so successful. Everyone looks at Juventus and thinks that's success now, but not to the Agnellis. Now they're thinking, no, I'm not going to get into the Super League or anything like that, but they're thinking three, four steps ahead.
Yeah.
So for me here, there's a possibility that, this is the start of a complete new beginning again. You know, and you've got a thing, the rest of Serie A are still trying to catch up with the existing Juve. I've said this before, every single season, every, you know, Inter, Milan may go, right, we're going to improve 5%. Juve improved 10. And so for me here, I don't know how it's going to go, but I can understand thinking behind it, that they want to create not just winning, but winning in style. And and if it comes off, it could be frightening.
Very well said, Richard. It's always wonderful to catch up with you. Everyone check out Richard's fantastic articles on Football Italia. Definitely check him out when he's on SiriusXM, those of you based in the U.S. And thanks again for joining me today and sharing your great perspectives on calcio.
Thanks, Dave. It's always a pleasure to come on. Thank you so much.
That's the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to everyone who sent in a question. As you guys know, we record a lot of these. So if you have another question on Serie A, transfers, TV, music, film, please send it in using the CalcioLand hashtag. And if you enjoyed the show, this is a free show available to all. Please leave us a review on iTunes. It takes 2 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating. If you leave a comment, Alex and I read them all. And these testimonials are great because they are from our listeners. They help us attract a bigger audience. And if you like all the content on the CalcioLand podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. We have various tiers for you just to listen enhanced version of the podcast. We have a tier where you can read a lot of original blogs from me. We'll have Alex once in a while do a video, and I answer a lot of questions there. I think that'll be a lot of fun year-round, and especially during the transfer window. So thank you very much for the support, and we look forward to chatting with you in the next few days.